morning. This is Jim Santel with Morning Cannolis here at WAUK Radio, the Shaw in downtown Waukesha. But 540 AM, 101 FM, we are taking your phone calls throughout this second hour of Morning Cannolis. That number, once again, 844-967-2789. I'm in the studios here on beautiful Wisconsin Avenue here in downtown Waukesha. My producer is Connor, as he is always diligent and with me, taking your phone calls and sending those in for our discussion this morning. I promised in our first hour, and I'm going to make good on it in our second hour here, that we would talk more about the Wisconsin Sick Temple shooting that happened 10 years ago yesterday, almost at exactly this time in the 10 o'clock hour of the morning, as members of the Sick Faith, the Sick Gurdwara in Oak Creek, were assembling for their Sunday morning services. I'm going to tell you more about exactly what happened as a part of history to ensure that we understand the past and we can learn from it and then also move forward, and also going to be talking this hour about the things that have happened since that time to make the world perhaps a bit better of a place for congregations like the Sikhs and Muslims and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and Christians, people of all faiths, to get together and worship as they choose. Nonetheless, still facing huge challenges here in America, including threats of violence, which we have regrettably seen even after the Sick violence on August 5th of 2012. Places like the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and other places around our nation. And so let's begin by talking about who it was who did this, who engaged in this horrific violent behavior 10 years ago at this time. He does have a name, but consistent with our general journalism practices and the practices of our traditions, we're not going to say his name today. We know that when those individuals survive these shootings, we do know their names, and they are in the public domain because they are prosecuted. In this case, we know that the shooter killed himself, and we'll get to that in just a few moments. And because of that, he was plainly not prosecuted. We found out additionally that he acted alone, and so no prosecution coming out of this. But nonetheless, a lot of lessons to be learned about who he was, where he came from, and like so many other shooters that we now know about, including very recently in Buffalo and also in Highland Park, just on the 4th of July of this year. We know that they come from these terrible, horrible cocktails of personal disaffection and disillusion and dismay and upsetness and anger with things beyond themselves and things internal to themselves. And the shooter on August 5th of 2012 falls into that category perfectly. We know he was born in 1971. He died on that day, August 5th of 2012. We know as well, he was undeniably a white supremacist. He lived for a long period of time in Cudahy, Wisconsin. He was born and he grew up in Colorado, where much of his family still remains. We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. Part of his growing up, his life in movement toward this horrific day in Oak Creek, was that he served in the U.S. military from about April of 1992 through October of 1998. During the course of that service in the United States Army, he repaired Hawk missile systems and became an operations specialist. Eventually, perhaps some of the first signals of things going wrong, he was demoted and received a general discharge at the time for what were called patterns of misconduct, including being drunk while on duty and being absent without leave. We also know, having investigated this matter and going back and trying to figure out where he came from, what he did, that this shooter was also undeniably exposed to and became a part of this unbelievably violent and counter-human notion that white supremacy is the future of America, the future of our state. And so even while he was in the United States military and exposed to people who promoting white power music and white power thoughts and principles, and that's where he got his first taste of this and his first connections to a group called the Hammerskins, again, a white nationalist, white supremacist group that ultimately landed him at the Sikh Gurdwara on August 5th of 2012. Even before that happened, however, we know that Page, after the shooter here, after he was discharged from the army, he went to Colorado. He lived there where his family was. He was in a Denver suburb called Littleton from about 2000, the year 2000, until 2007. He worked there as a truck driver from about 2006 to 2007. Again, from that employment, fired after receiving a citation for impaired driving due to drinking. So again, this pattern of bad behavior, bad asocial, antisocial behavior, and that brought him again to Wisconsin. We know that during the course of his engagements with his family, not only in Colorado, but also on the East Coast, his family basically disowned him and recognized that inside all of this ugliness that he was promoting, the ascendancy of the white race and this white supremacy view that he had, even though his mother came forward after the shooting and said that she had very little contact with him for the previous 12 years, she was much aware of the fact because of that, because of his past involvement, his present involvement in that white supremacist group and his tendencies in that direction. She had all but disowned him after divorcing his father, who again remained in Colorado. Father, likewise, putting him at arm's length and again removing him from any support that he may have had inside his family. A former friend at the time described him as a loner, and said that on a regular basis he had talked about an impending racial holy war, a racial holy war coming to America. Many neighbors likewise commented on the same kind of behavior. We know, as I already indicated, that he became affiliated with this group called the Hammerskins, this white supremacist group, entering into the white power music scene in about the year 2000, became involved in several neo-Nazi bands at the time. And he founded a particular band called The End Apathy in 2005 and played in other bands called Definite Hate and Blue Eyed Devils. And they were all of them considered racist white power bands. And the Southern Poverty Law Center, this wonderful, amazing group that tracks these kinds of things, the hate incidents in America, identified those groups, those bands, as being especially virulent, especially ugly when it comes to white supremacy. And Page, the fellow who was the shooter here, not only engaged in those bands, but also a part of this white supremacy movement. The shooter also we know, eventually comes back to Wisconsin and finds his way back to Cudahy. He has a romantic interest there. And eventually she also disowns him and says this is not something that she can tolerate. And that relationship likewise devolves. We know that in the days and weeks right before this happened, people who saw him in and about Cudahy, other places in southeastern Wisconsin, were reporting on the fact that his behavior became more and more radical and more odd. He put up black covers over the windows at his apartment. Many people saying that, again, living alone, rarely leaving his apartment, avoiding eye contact with people in and about that time. So again, an awful lot of indications, as we have seen in other circumstances, that the shooter in this case was in fact losing touch, not only with any sort of support that he might have out there, but becoming more and more alone. And sure enough, in the last days, not only did his girlfriend disown him, as his family had done, but the very group that he had associated with this white supremacist group, came to him and said, "You are no longer a part of our group." Why? Because they had discovered, true to their own virulent and ugly beliefs about America and about their own membership, relationship that the shooter had previously dated a woman of Native American heritage. So they disowned him. He is thrown out of that group as well. And so sometime in late July of 2012, the shooter does go into a gun shop in West Dallas, Wisconsin, and he buys a handgun. He buys a 9mm Springfield semi-automatic pistol. He does it legally. He passed the background checks that were required, paid cash for that gun, along with three 19-round magazines. And the owner of the gun shop, who is talked to, obviously investigated, as we'll get to, said that the shooter's appearance that time that he was there didn't raise any sort of eyebrows, didn't raise any sort of concerns or suspicions at that time, even as all these other indicators from family and from other people who had some contact with him indicated that he was indeed devolving. Again, this horrific cocktail of personality dysfunction and particular behaviors that certainly indicated that something horrific was going to happen. We know that there were photographs of the shooter that appeared in some media reports showing him with a range of tattoos on his arms and bodies. Most of those likewise establishing this connection to the white supremacist organization. And that brings him then to August 5th of 2012. As we know, as I will tell you in just a moment, reaffirming in just a moment, he died that morning. He killed himself, and so we can never reach quite into his mind, but it is undeniably a hate crime that happened on that morning. His decision, obviously, to go into this place of worship, this place of peace, to identify and to attack people who look different than he is, who he probably identified as being contrary to his own white supremacist group theories, and so he attacked. And right after the break, we'll talk more about what the shooter did, his activities that day, also taking your callers about this revisiting of history and the lessons we take from this horrific tale of what happened that morning. We're taking those calls at 844-967-2789. This is Morning Cannolis, a special session in the remaining time this morning, talking about the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Join us for this discussion.